I'm here today in the peaceful surroundings of St. Patrick's College of Education in Dublin with Dr. Lawrence Cox. You're welcome, Lawrence.
Thanks.
Lawrence is at the Department of Sociology in Maynooth University. His primary interest is in social movement studies, and he's a co-founder of the practitioner-oriented journal called Interface. And he's also co-chair of the Council for European Studies Social Movements Research Network. But another field of your research, Lawrence, is in Buddhist studies. And you co-founded the Irish Society for the Academic Study of Religion and co-organised Ireland's first academic conference on new religious movements and Assessor's second conference. And you've also twice guest-edited the Journal of Contemporary Buddhism. So we might talk a little bit about that, but I guess from my own point of view as a geographer, I'm interested in how in mobility and the mobility of cultural practices, particularly as it relates to the religious. So your work has focused on the story of one particular Irishman, maybe to kind of help us understand Buddhism's relationship with what we might loosely call the West.
Okay, well, this Irishman, as we come to know of him, is ordained in Rangoon, colonial Rangoon, in 1900. So at the height of the British Empire, really. He's somebody we believe to have been born in Booterstown in South Dublin, worked his way across the Atlantic as a young emigrant via probably Liverpool and New York, works as a sailor up and down the East Coast, perhaps on inland waterways through as far as the Great Lakes, Chicago, and then westwards to California and the Trans-Pacific lines. So we see somebody, in a sense, a very classic Irish route of mobility. And then winding up as a poor white in Asia. And in focusing on empire, we tend to focus on great military leaders, colonial figures, and scholars. But in a country like India, more than half of the whites who were there were poor. They were very often ex-soldiers, ex-sailors, beachcombers, and so on. And they're a very problematic population from the point of view of the colonial authorities.
Okay, so we might talk a little bit about how we problematize that later. So this Irishman, Lawrence Carroll, was, as you say, a kind of a traditional migrant who would have emigrated across the United States in the early part of the 20th century. At what stage was his intention always perhaps to become the Buddhist monk, or was it a conversion process maybe that he met as he went across the United States and thence into Asia?
Well, if you think of one of the traditional roles of religion in mobility, it's to provide access to ethnic networks and very strongly, of course, for the Irish abroad, to provide jobs. And I think it's very clear that if somebody becomes what at the time would have been called a race traitor in Asia, stepping out of white privilege, but also converting from Christianity. These kinds of things were the subjects of moral panics. It's almost certainly because he had chosen not to or not been able to do this at some previous point. And in fact, in that trajectory I've just mentioned, there is ethno-religious boundary after ethno-religious boundary. So Irish Catholic and English Protestant in Liverpool, Irish and black in New York, and very much as hobos. There are huge conflicts because this is the post-Civil War period. There are demobilized soldiers. There are also southern blacks coming north. He moves through, on his own account, Montana in the period between Red Cloud's War and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And then California, where he says he was working with Chinese coolies, was at this time a site of nativist, so white American, anti-Chinese, racism, riots, attacks on Chinese temples and so on.
Yes.
So I think we have to imagine somebody stepping out of that use of religion and coming, as, you know, of course, many people do still today, to convert to a religion, I think, through an identification of religion with a particular culture.
Mm.
Arriving in Burma, loving Burma, finding himself much more at home with the ordinary Burmese than with the white establishment.
Mm.
I think we're looking at that kind of trajectory.
Yeah, there's a couple of different elements there you've drawn together. I suppose maybe just briefly we might kind of explore this sense of, firstly, of boundaries, of crossing those boundaries. Clearly, it's a migration and or pilgrimage experience, but it's also about boundaries between ethnic religious categories, if you will. And then secondly, we might talk a little bit about that element of race and racism in the Irish, maybe if we wanted to speak a little bit about that. So just in terms of boundaries, what does Carol's story tell us about crossing those boundaries?
Well, we know that there was always a substantial number of people, of Europeans going native in Asia from an early point, unsurprisingly. However, it hasn't been very deeply studied. There is rather more study in research and literary studies on moral panics about Europeans going native. And this is particularly a process after the Indian Mutiny. Prior to the Indian Mutiny, it was quite common for Europeans in India to have Indian wives and to stay with them, indeed, even to convert to Islam, Hinduism, or whatever. After the Mutiny, in particular, the British in Asia become very clear there are not very many of us, and they start to insist on much tighter boundaries around religion, around sex, around behaviour.
Mm.
And these are the things that are challenged in a general way by poor whites who fail to behave in this very special way that is expected of members of the master race. Not least because, unlike the white poor in the Deep South, they are a second class, almost a second caste. Mm. And particularly their children who haven't been brought up in England do not have the same privileges that those who have come out from the metropolis do. So the extreme of that, and the extreme in literary imagining as well as in reality, is the Buddhist convert, because here's somebody who doesn't wear shoes, a European who is wearing native dress, who is begging, and who has converted away from Christianity, which in this period is becoming increasingly a justification of empire, much more so than in the 18th century, when the view was fairly cynical one of, you know, we're here for military and economic purposes and don't disturb the natives, don't mess with native religion. By the 20th century, Britain is a democracy and empire abroad is justified certainly by education, by women's rights and so on, but also by we are bringing the gospel. So a European who converts from Christianity to Buddhism is a serious challenge to that.
So I guess some of those boundaries and categories you've been speaking about there kind of cross over kind of an alternate history of the Irish abroad. You know, the traditional story we both tell ourselves and the rest of the world is of a white diaspora enhanced in its Catholicism or its Protestantism in the earlier part of the 19th century. So what does Lawrence Carroll or Damaloka's story tell us about the intersection then, or the representation of Buddhism in the West in particular?
I think one way of looking at that is to say that we very often had quite a textual and elite-focused representation of what people knew, which is misleading going back a long, long way. So in medieval Ireland, as elsewhere in medieval Europe, one of the most popular representations of Buddhism is that found in the legendary, in the Alexander legend, where Alexander is said to have met Indian ascetics who say, well, you know, you're violent, you're greedy, you eat meat, look at us, we're virtuous, and so on. And of course, this puts in a safely distant mouth a criticism of one's own local elites.
Sure.
And this particular exchange circulated independently and very, very widely in Western Europe. So this use of elsewhere to criticize the way things were here. And we find that, of course, in the Enlightenment. We find it today, where people will say, well, in the East, this, that, or the other. J.J. Clarke talks about this as a dissident Orientalism, a use of the other, not as we've, as researchers often focused on, to reinforce our own culture, but in fact to critique our own culture. But the other aspect of it is that empire depended on an awful lot of ordinary people. And very, very many of those were Irish, going as far back as the 14th century, but certainly by the 18th century. There are lots of Irish people in Asia, and many of them never go home. So you start families, you work out your own relationship to the local culture, whatever it is, and that kind of knowledge or that kind of relationship to religion becomes very powerful for some people. Now, in the period we're looking at, in relation to Damalocha, so the early 20th century, Irish people in Asia quite often think about religion in Asia in the same way that they think about religion in Ireland. So they say there is a local religion, and there is a religion of the colonial power. And this is one of the things that Damalocha, he's not the only person importing it, but he's a very important figure in doing so. He brings, in a sense, Daniel O'Connell's lesson to Asia. And Daniel O'Connell's lesson is, well, so in the 1820s and 1830s, the uprising of 1798 had been defeated, Ireland had become officially part of the United Kingdom. But O'Connell uses religious identity as a means of mobilising nationalist political power. And this is very much what Damalocha does in Asia as well. So he uses, he becomes a Buddhist, he uses the critique of missionaries as a way of criticising the colonial power. And in Burma this is particularly tense. So Burma had only finished being conquered in the late 1880s. There'd been a very brutal counterinsurgency campaign, literally a sea of blood. You could not stand up, even as a white person, and say, yeah, the British Empire could should go. But you certainly could, as a Buddhist monk, attack missionaries. And this he did very effectively, in a way that the Buddhist Sangha, the clerical hierarchy, couldn't. Now, he's ordained by some very, very senior figures. They clearly think he can work in this world, we can't. You know, they are still at some level. They would like to re-establish the monarchy, and indeed their negotiations with the British to have this sort of ruler of the Sangha appointed by, so that they're in a, you know, what we might call a reactionary phase. But that's not the only card they're playing. They're also ordaining this guy, who goes out and becomes a celebrity preacher. You know, people will travel for 3 days on ox carts to come and hear him preach. And what he says is the moral order is under threat. Christianity is coming. Assert yourself as Buddhists and as Burmese. And this, by the 1920s, after his time, has become the central message of Burmese nationalism and is what leads to the Burmese state as it becomes.
So there's that kind of crucial alliance then at a certain stage between nationalism and religion that he would have known from his own experience growing up in Ireland.
Yes. Now, it's a complicated area because in his own time, and I think for himself, it's primarily an anti-colonial response. It's not yet what we would call a modern nationalist response. That comes later. And indeed, a lot of his allies are not from the central Burman ethnicity, or indeed when he's active in Thailand or Singapore, Penang, the same is true. The people that he's working with are very often from the more minor ethnicities, so the Dawé, who are spread across several of these countries, the Araucanese, and so on and so forth, who are part themselves. They're pursuing a different strategy again, which doesn't succeed, but they are among the first groups to really invest in what we call the Buddhist revival of the late 19th century, which is where, in much of colonial Asia, and indeed in independent countries, Japan and Thailand, people come to have a more political consciousness of Buddhism as a pan-Asian religion, and therefore as an alternate route to modernity and a challenge to empire. So the Araucanese, for example, are not only engaged with Dhammaloka, they're among the first sponsors of Dharmapala, founding the Mahabodhi Society, attempting to regain control of the Mahabodhi Temple in India, a place, a part of India where there are no Buddhists at this point, as part of that global Buddhism. And at this point, the national sanghas, if you like, are holding on to their own local power. It's only later that they swing in behind the Dharmapalas and this new mode of nationalist Buddhism.
So there's a series then of a series of fascinating boundaries being crossed at the time that Dhammaloka's becoming established in that part of the world, which relate to both colonial and anti-colonial struggles across boundaries, across national boundaries, as they were imposed by colonial powers.
It was extraordinarily complicated for people at the time to grasp.
Yes.
They are, we might say that they're using religion metaphorically or whatever, but they have to have a language which they understand and which other people understand to say, this is what's going on and this is what we are doing. If I can move temporarily to another Irish figure, Charles Fownes, who organises the first Buddhist mission to the West. This is in London from 1889 to 1892. This is coming for Fownes now. He is the delegate of a Japanese Buddhist missionary society, which is starting to engage in this process of how do we bring Buddhism to the West. And, of course, under the Meiji, the Japanese have to work out what is religion in the first place.
Okay.
And Japanese, what we would now call political and religious elites, but of course they don't think in those terms.
Yes.
They send delegation after delegation to Europe. Fownes comes with one of them as an interpreter. In the period, so after the defeat of the Paris Commune and the building of the Basilica of Montmartre, but it's also the Kulturkampf in Germany. It's just after disestablishment of the Irish Church. And they go around and they talk to, you know, Max Müller and so on to say, well, what is religion? What is the state? Mm. How should church and state relate? Mm. And they bring this back to Japan. Mm. And in a remarkably modern way, you know, they make proposals and they work out, not without many internal conflicts, this is how we're going to do church and state in Japan.
Yes,
it's extraordinary.
So this reminds me, it's a kind of an ebb and flow of various processes then that don't always make a coherent story, and they transfer across territories in ways that perhaps people might find from a European point of view, kind of startling to think that there'd be missions from the East to the West and that had a recursive influence back on the East. I suppose then what we're asking here is there a sense in which Buddhism is being created both for as a unified construct in the West, but also as an ethno-religious category in South Asia?
Yes, and I think we have to think of several different competing strategies, sometimes from the same people, around this. Because by this period, Buddhism is no longer a missionary religion in Asia, with the possible exception of the odd hill tribe. So it's been a long time since any of the people who were involved in missionary activity, they have no practical sense of how to convert. They look at Christians And of course, the Christian missionary effort is not very effective in many places. The Irish missionary effort is much more about getting rid of surplus people from Ireland. People are sent abroad with no sense of the local language. They look, so the Maynooth mission to China in the late 1910s, early 1920s, they look with awe at an Irish person who can read the newspaper. Both Christians and Buddhists, looking at this Christian experience, misread the areas where Christians do have success and go, well, if they've got a young men's Christian association, let's have a young men's Buddhist association.
I see.
Here's a tract, a gospel tract society, let's have a Buddhist tract society. And of course, what's missed is that where Christianity is effective is largely in minority ethnicities, which attach themselves to this new religion on the logic of the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yes, yeah.
Rather than because of any particular organizing strength. So Buddhists developing what is global Buddhism, trying to work that out for themselves, they're really fumbling in the dark.
Yes, at this time.
At this time. And what we now think of as global Buddhism is the product of a long struggle around this, in particular, I suppose, the discovery, let me see, how can I put this best? Kate Crosby says that one of the ways in which this is argued out is to say that if the West has mastery of physical science, Asia has mastery of mental science, therefore meditation.
Yes.
And certainly what does turn out to be transmittable is Buddhism as practice, be it meditation or chanting or initiation, in the case, for example, of Tibetan Buddhism. That fits in part with theosophical, occultist, mesmerist, spiritualist modes of new religion in the West, but it also turns out to be transmissible. It doesn't depend on being born within a particular ethnic community. And it provides a coherent answer to this question, which in my own research I found this character founds struggling with. When you've given a lecture about Buddhism, when people are interested, what do you get them to do? The answer for Western Buddhists now is very clear, is you start a meditation course.
Okay. Yeah.
Or the equivalent.
Yes.
It's not clear back then.
Yes.
And they're finding their way towards, what is religion? What does it mean to be Buddhist? In the very practical sense of, if we convert people, what is it that we want them to do?
Many of those struggles would be familiar to perhaps mainline evangelical Christian churches as well, in that the emphasis tends to be, again, based on text as opposed to practice. And the idea of secularization in Europe certainly being a focus on the textual rather than the practical. To what extent then might we kind of understand the study of religions as a whole, to how can we account for that through this kind of coherence we now know as Buddhism? Might we perhaps find a way into the study of religion? A big question, I know. through this idea of the coherence of something called Buddhism, which derived through its practice as opposed to its textual readings, or... That's a really big question.
It is a big question. I think certainly in the West, many people are engaged in that process in a normative way. I think from an academic point of view, and I would personally take a Marxist view on this, which is to say, society or the world or the human constitution doesn't have a boundary around that which is inherently religious. It doesn't work this way. Pierre Hadot shows this very neatly in relation to the philosophy of the ancient scholia, and the way in which the spiritual exercises associated with, for example, the Stoa or the Epicureans as a religious community, the kind of thing reflected in Marcus Aurelius's meditations, that is lost once the schools are dispersed and these become simply bodies of texts. And indeed, the church, in Western Europe establishes itself the boundaries around that which is the province of philosophy, mm-hmm. and where one can profitably read the pagans, and that which is the province of religion. So these boundaries are constantly, we say negotiated, but of course these are huge, huge power relationships. And in Asia, in Dhammaloka's time, a focus on meditation is still pretty marginal in most of Buddhist Asia. What matters is ordination. What matters is the power relations within individual sanghas. Earlier on, we were speaking about boundaries within Europe, within the colonial world, over who is a white. We talk about Dhammaloka as being one of the first Western Buddhists. He is in some ways, this probably isn't the case, he's one of the first visible Western Buddhists because he is now a figure of moral panic for Europeans in a way that he might not have been 100 years previously. Mm-hmm. But this is also true from the Asian point of view. Countries like Burma or Thailand, which had previously had a multiplicity of different Buddhist hierarchies, with much more flexibility given to individual monasteries, they are taking the European lesson that you need a national church, closely allied to the central power. And therefore, from this point of view, ordaining a European becomes something much more problematic, something which perhaps is done by a minority ethnic sangha, the Dewe, rather than the central sangha. And indeed, what happens repeatedly is that Europeans who want to become monks go to Ceylon, which is seen very often as the heart of Buddhism, and they're sent away.
Yes.
They're told, I can't ordain you. You know, you don't fit within our categories. If you go to Burma, this is clearly said, as sort of out. If you go to Burma, they'll be willing to ordain you there.
Okay.
And that route is followed. We have no evidence that it's followed by Dhammaloka, but we see a lot of other early Buddhist monks following this kind of route, trying to find the places in the Asian sanghas which are still happy to ordain Europeans. Yes. And then, of course, later that changes again.
Yes. It's a fascinating story of boundary crossings, I suppose for anyone coming to this afresh and they would like to maybe find out a little bit more, you've mentioned Kate Crosby's work, but is there anybody in particular you think people might be able to access so that they could learn a little bit more about what you've been speaking about?
Well, I should plug my own book, Buddhism and Ireland, and say that we've put much of the research coming out of this on a single website, the Dhammaloka Project, so that's quite easy to find.
Yeah, we'll make that available on the webpage.
At this point, Lawrence is talking about a book by an author called Kaori Nagai, Empire of Analogies.
Kim is, by Kipling, is this extraordinarily popular book in the early 20th century, including in Ireland. And it's the story of a poor white. So his father is an Irish sergeant who, when demobilised, as very often happened, got a job on the railways and marries an Indian bazaar woman. And they both die, so the young Kim is an Irish Indian orphan who is torn, this is the burden of the story, between working for the spy masters of the British Raj or his Tibetan Buddhist guru. That tension is absolutely central to the book. What Nagai says is we have to understand that this analogy, Ireland-India, is an aspect of a much broader set of analogies around the nature of colonialism, which at this point is the majority experience in the world. Most of the world is colonizer or colonized, except for Latin America. Which by this point is post-colonial in most cases. And it is not just the Irish Buddhists in Asia who say, in some ways, we were colonized too, and we understand this conflict between local religion and imperial power. Imperial civil servants think in these very same terms.
Yes.
And they range from the hardliners who were responsible for the massacre at Amritsar, who say, you know, you have to deal with this kind of stuff with a firm hand, I know what this means in Ireland, and for whom then figures like Edward Carson and Winston Churchill step in back in Britain. And on the other hand, figures like Chief Justice Toomey, who's involved in trying Damoloco at one point, although we see him there in a conflictual role, his magnum opus is an attempt to show how to marry British colonial law with Burmese ecclesiastical legislation.
Right, okay.
And you can see in that the inheritance of the Irish experience going,
yes.
We have to make these two things work together.
Yes.
And of course, in a place like St. Patrick's here, this relationship where the British state had in effect handed over large chunks of what we now think of as statehood, so education,
healthcare,
and so on, and of course the policing of morality with the Magdalene asylums and so on, all of this had been handed over to the church in Ireland.
Mm.
So Toomey in Burma going, how do we negotiate these two legal systems, is doing something that is immediately recognisable in those terms.
In a kind of a mainline Marxist way, the contradictions become quite apparent to those who are administering the contradictory system. Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And they were trained in this, you know, because I mean, I've talked about how poorly the Irish missionaries were trained.
At this point, Lawrence is talking about Irish missionaries. His comments were specifically about the late period of Catholic missionary activity. And this is both Irish Protestant missionaries and Irish missionaries who were part of earlier missions organised elsewhere, but were better prepared. So his main point about that generation of Irish missionaries to Buddhist Asia was that they were not seriously prepared at all for missionary activity. And the contrast with Trinity College Dublin, Oriental Studies, who trained people for the Indian Civil Service, is stark in this respect. Graduates of the Civil Service Asian Languages program, for example, classical and modern, law, religion, culture, etc., were missionaries of this period. And if they had any language training, they did it overseas, but more commonly, not at all. There is a story of missionaries looking in awe at Galvin because he could actually read the local newspaper. The curricula were all about theology, together with Gaelic sports, elocution, and music. In fact, by comparison with what can be shown of general popular knowledge of Buddhism in the Ireland of the day, missionaries appear as peculiarly ignorant.